This is the last week where I am talking about right effort, and right effort is the sixth step in the Eightfold Path, and it is a very important topic for Buddhists for a variety of reasons, and one reason is that the Buddha said, the Buddha only points the way, it's up to you to make the effort. So there has to be effort involved in practice. And there's another quote that is quite a, I think quite a, for me, very powerful quote by the, from the Buddha. He said, the Dharma is for the industrious, not for the lazy. I'm not sure what the Pali for industrious is, since they didn't have industry back then. But the Dharma is for the industrious, not for the lazy. So here, the importance of effort is important, of applying oneself, of engagement. And if you just kind of sit back and are lazy, nothing will happen. The Dharma, the Buddha's only point the way, it's up for you to make effort. And part of the reason for that is the Dharma is something each of us needs to discover for ourselves. It's not something that's discovered. You can read books and learn some of the principles of Dharma in books, for example, or in teachings. But it's not a matter of understanding the principles, but it's a matter, in a sense, of self-discovery. Discovery how these principles apply in our own lives. And only we can discover that. And we discover that by making some kind of effort. So we have to make effort. And the question is, what kind of effort do we make? And in the first discourse in the Samyutta Nikaya, one of the great collections of the Buddha's discourses, there's someone asks the Buddha about how do you cross the flood. The flood is used to represent the floods of delusion, the floods of greed, hate, and delusion, the floods of that kind of drown people in suffering. So how do you cross the flood? And the Buddha said, not by standing still and not by striving do you get across the flood. And so the person asks for clarification, what does that mean? And the Buddha says, if you stand still, you'll drown. And if you strive, if you struggle, you'll be swept away by the flood. So what's the alternative between stopping or halting and striving and straining? So one of the ways of seeing that is it's some kind of balanced effort, some kind of effort which doesn't have strain in it, but also not holding back and resisting, you know, reluctant to make an application, just waiting. If you sit and wait long enough, you know, something will happen. As Ajahn Sumedho says, if sitting was where it was at, if you just had to sit long enough, chickens would be enlightened. So there has to be some kind of engagement. And some of you maybe had the experience of doing something like hiking in the mountains, maybe going for a long hike, maybe even going backpacking for many days. And perhaps the effort that's made initially, uphill, you know, body's not in condition, it's kind of a struggle, kind of you have to make strong effort. But at some point you get going, body gets conditioned well enough and you get into the flow of it, and you can actually carry on at a fairly nice pace, good pace, not vigorous, it's not lazy, it's not held back, and it feels, for a while at least, maybe it could be for a few hours, depending on how long you hike, it can feel like you're in a flow, like in a rhythm, like in an ease. And it feels appropriate, the energy, the vigor is there. You don't feel like you're pushing, but there's a good pace going on. And I suspect that a lot of endeavors that are repetitive in nature, when you engage and you get into it, after a while you can get into a kind of a flow or a rhythm. There's a lot of energy being expended. So if you go backpacking and you're really in on the trail and really kind of chugging along, there's a lot of energy being expended. But you might say that there's no effort being expended in a funny way. In the sense that the energy is there, but your kind of body's in this rhythm, and it's just kind of, you're being carried along by the effort, by the momentum that's been created. And there isn't that kind of mental willing that maybe had to happen at the beginning of the trail when you were not in condition, not warmed up. There's no will anymore, that kind of effort. Exactly. So the same thing can happen with Dharma practice. In Dharma practice, sometimes when people start practicing, there can be, you know, it's uphill. It's difficult to get going. I'm going to sit every day. This meditation seems really great. I'm going to sit every day. And we sit the first day. And then about 2 months later, you remember, wait a minute, I'm supposed to sit every day. I think now I'm really going to try. And you sit 2 days, and a month goes by, you know, or something. It's sometimes it's really hard to get going for some people. Or even sitting, if a person does sit every day, even then it can be hard to get going. The mind wanders away. And you find yourself kind of, it's very easy to be lazy in meditation and not really engaged. And so, or it's possible to kind of bear down and strive in some way, which is not helpful either. So how do you get to that place where you kind of have a good ongoing engagement in the practice you might be doing? So effort is important, and effort is really important in the teachings of the Buddha. Much more so than you sometimes will pick up from me, maybe, sometimes other Western teachers, where sometimes there's a kind of emphasis on acceptance or being at ease, resting in the natural ease of the mind, and just let things happen just by themselves and all that. And it seems, you know, it's kind of like an easygoing approach to a spiritual life. I'd like to read from these teachings of the Buddha. When he talked about right effort. And some of you, those of you who've been here now know that really well the four right efforts. In defining right effort, the Buddha defined it as being four kinds of appropriate effort. And they're kind of overall principles. If you have a goal in mind, if you have a purpose in mind, then there are four efforts you should make to attain that goal. And one effort is you should avoid doing those things that get in the way of your goal. You should, if you're doing something that gets in the way of your goal, you should stop doing it. You should do those things which help you get to your goal, and you should maintain and continue doing those things which support you moving to that goal, that direction or that orientation. And those are the four efforts. They're supposed to apply in all kinds of endeavors, even when you drive here in the morning to get to IMC or wherever you're going to drive next. You need to have some sense of the four right efforts, right? If you're live in San Jose and you start driving down to Santa Cruz, but really you want to come here to Redwood City, you're making the wrong effort. The direction you're going is the wrong, you know, it's not helping you. You need to kind of stop going in that direction, turn around, come the other direction. And then you have to maintain. You know, it's one thing to set yourself on 101 going north from San Jose, say, I'm heading there to IMC, and then say, well, you know, I think I'll just stop along the side of the freeway and read the newspaper. You know, you'll never get here. You have to maintain the effort you're going. So the idea of the four right efforts is supposed to apply to all kinds of areas of inner life. Now, applying it to our Dharma practice, the Buddha had this to say. And this is the kind of the traditional way of describing the four right efforts. The first one has to do about letting go, stopping doing those things that get in the way, those things you're doing that are getting in the way. Here, a bhikkhu, a monk, awakens zeal. That's zeal. That's a strong word, right? Awakens zeal for the non-arising, unarisen, unskillful states. That just means stop doing things that get in the way. Don't do those things which are going to get in the way. So things that are not happening yet, avoid letting them happen. So he makes zeal for the non-arising of unarisen, unskillful states. And the bhikkhu makes effort, arouses energy, exerts his or her mind, and strives. That's a lot of energy. You know, this is not for the lazy, right? Apply yourself. The bhikkhu awakens zeal for the abandoning of arisen unskillful states, and makes effort, arouses energy, exerts the mind, and strives. The bhikkhu awakens zeal for the bhikkhu awakens zeal for the arising of unarisen skillful states, and makes effort, arouses energy, exerts the mind, and strives. The bhikkhu awakens zeal for the continuance, non-disappearance, strengthening, increase, and fulfillment by development of arisen skillful states, and makes effort, arouses energy, exerts the mind, and strives. This is called right effort. It's a lot of effort. It's exhausting. And for people who are already living exhausting lives, you know, struggling and straining, and they come to meditation because it's supposed to be the antidote. And here they're basically saying, make strong effort. What you have to know is that the appropriate effort for any person has to do with their condition, with their situation in life. And when people are stressed out, the appropriate effort might be to relax. And do that, relax, in an have zeal. Relaxation can be a skillful state. So you should have zeal for relaxing. Make effort, arouse energy, exert your mind, and strive to relax well. You can do that. And you can be very diligent through the mind to keep the mind relaxed, or to keep your not get caught, not get stressed by what goes on within you. Very, very diligent in staying open and spacious. Being open and spacious doesn't mean you don't make effort. And so there's a kind of a natural corrective. You know, you're not supposed to make this kind of effort, strong effort in meditation, so you feel even more exhausted than you are from your daily life. But you need to make some effort. And a very diligent effort can be, if you're stressed, the very diligent effort can be to relax. Until you're relaxed enough. And once you're relaxed enough, then you might want to think about doing other things with your meditation practice rather than just relaxing. Relaxing is a dead-end path. It's pretty wonderful to be relaxed. But if that's all your meditation is, you're going to be like a chicken. You know, it's pretty good, but it's not going to go all the way. So in the discussion last week was then to cultivate. One of the things you can do is cultivate skillful states. One of the skillful states is mindfulness. It's considered to be one of the supremely skillful states to cultivate, being mindful of what's happening in the present moment. And for some people, mindfulness can seem as a call to not do anything about what's happening in your experience, but simply be aware of it. Just note, be aware of what's happening right now. But it's wonderful to do that. Just be not before or against anything, not manipulate, not to change your experience, but to cultivate the ability just to be present in a kind of clear way for what's happening. Have that equanimity of mind to be able to do that. But even then, the bhikkhu awakens zeal for mindfulness and makes effort, arouses energy, exerts the mind, and strives for that kind of non-reactive presence, of non-reactive awareness. I've had this certain experience of saying, I'm going to sit here and be mindful, present for what is, allow whatever is here to be what here. I'm not going to be for or against it. I'm just going to feel it, experience it, just be fully present. And then I wake up 5 minutes later. That was, you know, because there wasn't that, there wasn't the energy, the engagement in that practice. So I was kind of complacent and, you know, wandering around. And I think it's sooner or later for a lot of people who practice, complacency can be a hindrance, especially in meditation practice. And it was a hindrance for me for longer than I care to admit. I was able to get fairly comfortable and calm in my meditation. It was very pleasant to sit. And in that enjoyment of my sitting, in that calm and settled state, I just kind of started, just kind of lulled myself to sleep. Everything's fine, thank you. Everything's fine, it's wonderful, you know. Just so wonderful to be here. And I just fall asleep. And I needed to learn that to be awake, to be really engaged, is also an engagement. It has to be kind of... And that engagement sometimes has to be an application of effort. But once it gets going, it can be like backpacking or hiking. It's there. It's naturally flowing and present. So in the third step of these four right efforts, it's cultivating wholesome or skillful states, and one of them is mindfulness. There are six others, which are sometimes mentioned as being very important, and they are important. And that is, with mindfulness, the other of the seven factors of awakening. And that is, mindfulness practice involves cultivating and developing in some way, either actively or passively, because often these kind of come in the wake of strong mindfulness, somewhat allowing for the development of mindfulness, investigation, effort or energy, joy, tranquility, concentration, and equanimity. Seven factors. Some people say these seven factors of awakening is the sap that runs through the tree of awakening, the sap that runs through, the blood that runs through that sustains awakening practice. And these seven factors of awakening will slowly, over time, develop in people whose mindfulness practice gets stronger. One of the places where they develop the most strongly is on retreat. And sometimes, it takes sometimes a long retreat, especially people who are new, to really get the sap flowing strongly. So they really become strongly part of who we are, these seven factors. But I think even practicing every day, you know, practicing mindfulness, practicing effort, slowly, even in subtle ways, hopefully these seven, some of these seven factors of awakening begin showing themselves to you. You begin feeling like you have some momentum in mindfulness. You tend to wake up more often, or pay attention more often, or interest in paying attention more often as you go through your day. And your capacity for being present gets more and more clear. You learn how to be present without the filters of judgments, for example. And then over time you learn that your capacity for investigation gets interesting, gets more available, more present. So, for example, a silly example, but in the middle of last night, my kids woke up. And one of them woke up with a cough and needed attention, and the other one woke up for... Sometimes you don't know why they wake up. But they need attention. It was cold, and got out of bed and took care of the kids, especially because it was so cold in her house. I went back into bed, and I was really awake. You know, 2 o'clock, 2:30 in the night, you know. And so I couldn't go back to sleep right away, and I didn't want to get up and sit because it was so cold. And so I just laid there in bed. But pretty quickly, what I started doing was investigating. What's going on here? What's happening here? I'm laying here. It's very interesting to watch the mind. At least my mind is interesting to watch. And I noticed that, you know, as I often do if I'm awake in the middle of the night like that, I have some thoughts pass through my mind of, I was, oh no, I'm going to cope, I'm going to be so tired, I have to get up tomorrow morning and give a talk, and you know, this is not good. And a little bit I could, as I was investigating, look at those thoughts go through, I could actually feel that they were in some subtle way, they were toxic to me. You know, they kind of depressed me and kind of didn't make me feel good, the rest of me. And I thought, you know, that's kind of why do I do that? And then I thought, well, just maybe realistically, make other kinds of thoughts, skillful thoughts, the arising of skillful states. And I started thinking, oh, it's really nice here. It's warm in my bed. And I'm lucky to have a house, and you're lucky all these wonderful things, and you know, and actually nothing. There's no problem right now. It's safe, and I could feel how the toxic quality of the earlier thoughts went away, and I was feeling kind of happier from that. And but I was investigating. What I'm trying to say here was, I had an interest to investigate what was going on. It was close at hand, and I just right away started investigating what's happening here. And there was, what was also interesting is after a while of kind of shifting from kind of these more downer kind of thoughts to more upper kind of thoughts, this is exhausting. This is tiring to make the effort to think this way, even good thoughts. You know, it was nice for a while I did it, but now it's getting kind of old or tired, so I think I'll just be awake. I'll just be just present and here and come clear, relaxed way and just be present, just be. And pretty soon, after just doing that, and then I woke up about 2 hours later. I fell asleep. So this investigation is important. So to have a habit of it becomes something that becomes more part of our life, to be interested in investigating. And then to make effort. Effort becomes something that becomes more second nature. It's easier to do. The more we make effort, the easier it is to make effort, at least right effort. And then hopefully there's a beginning of some kind of joy, some feeling of being lighter or delighted, lighter from the practice you're doing, from your state, your quality of your being gets more improved, lighter and happier. And that's a really wonderful thing. It's not only appropriate, but in Buddhist spirituality, Buddhist Dharma life, it sooner or later you're expected to feel some joy in the practice, from the practice, some joy in life. Without it, it's very hard to go further in practice. And then tranquility, some ability to be calm, relaxed, tranquil, is a very important quality to cultivate and develop. It happens. Maybe you feel some degree of calm because you sit in the morning. And a little bit that those day mornings you sit, that calm carries with you the rest of the day, or part of the day. And then there's the ability to be concentrated. The mind starts getting stabilized. And so your mind's not scattered and jumping all over the place and running around and anxious about things. But when you're doing something, you have some stability. You're really here for this thing. You're present. And you really feel like you're here in yourself rather than spinning in your thoughts. So stability develops over time, concentration. And then a capacity for equanimity hopefully develops over time. Some equanimity meaning partly that you're not so likely to react to what happens. Whether something good happens or bad happens, you're not going to be caught by it. You're not going to react to it. And that becomes a skill, a capacity to develop over time by practicing. And so those are seven factors of awakening. Those will get cultivated. Now, in the fourth of the four right efforts, the practice is to maintain what has the skillful states that have arisen, to maintain them. And I think this is really important, because it's possible to engage in a spiritual life, in a dharmic life, and start having some nice things happening in our practice, and then stop practicing and those nice things fade away. Everything, we say in Buddhism, everything is impermanent. So even the seven factors of awakening are impermanent. Your strength of your mindfulness, your strength of your ability to be present to some degree, your strength of your ability to investigate, to make effort, to be happy, to be tranquil, to be concentrated, to be equanimous, all those are impermanent things. And they come and they go to some degree. It's natural, it's completely appropriate. Concentration, for example, has a lifetime. So if I sit down at times when I can get concentrated, I know that if I sit long enough, that concentration will go. It's natural. Sooner or later it will go. The more concentrated I am, the longer I can keep that concentration. But sooner or later it will go. And I can't tell you how many times on retreat I have suffered because the concentration went away. Then, you know, after a while I realized, well, it has its lifetime. It's, you know, why should I suffer about something, you know? You suffer because, you know, the seasons change. Some people do. But you expect them to change. You know, that's what's natural. So the seasons change in the mind. Sometimes there's concentration, sometimes there's not. And and you kind of ride the waves of it. You learn to surf. So it's, you surf on it when it's there, and then it goes away and something else, and then it comes back some other time. But it isn't just. But as we practice, the ability to get concentrated becomes stronger and stronger. It comes back more often, and it becomes more of a regular thing. But unless you maintain practice, it will fade away. So it's very important to maintain, keep the practice going, so your skills and your mental states, your good qualities, your inner strengths, can be sustained. To develop strong concentration and then not practice concentration anymore, you'll lose that capacity to some degree. So I love the analogy the Buddha gave of starting a fire by rubbing sticks together. You take two sticks. I've never tried this, but it's supposed to be possible. Maybe Boy Scouts have done it, maybe Girl Scouts have done this. Anybody done this? Ever rub sticks together to make a fire? You've done it. Did you succeed?
Made smoke.
You've done it? So it's possible. And so right, so the Buddha said that too. You said he had all these analogies. All these analogies about the right kinds of. If you have wet sticks, you can't do it. And so you can't, you know. So, and that the analogy is wet. And if you're full of doing evil things, you know, and you're lying and stealing and you know, whatever, then it's like you're really wet and you can't really get a spark. So you have to dry yourself out first. But then finally you get good dry sticks, even the best sticks around, and you start, you know, rubbing them, and you rub them for a while, and say, you know, this is a great time for tea. You put them down, you go get some tea. And then you come back from tea 10 minutes later, half an hour later, and you pick up those sticks, and you start again. Uh-oh, now I need to pee. You put them down. And it's all, you come back and you rub them. There's all these good things to do. Your freezer needs to be defrosted, or, you know, or you have to make those important phone calls, or there's emails to deal with, or so all these things that can be done. And so you never build up enough friction, enough heat to make a spark, make smoke even. So the same thing with the Dharma practice, that if what you want to do is cultivate and develop your capacities, you can't expect those capacities to be developed by intermittent practice. There has to be some continuity in practice over time. And so daily practice is often strongly stressed. Practice every day. Some people like to go on retreats. And so to go on retreats often enough, so there's some sense of continuity that happens. For some people, maybe it's even just once a year. Once a year, I'm going to go on retreat. But for some people, once a year gives enough some kind of continuity of being on retreat. Some people like to do it more often. Or there's other kind of practices, like the practices of generosity. Buddha said it's very important, skillful state to develop is your capacity for generosity. And you cultivate generosity by practicing it. And it can get kind of rusty if you don't practice it. So if you're inspired by this kind of development, then you keep it going. So there's a whole variety of things that in dharmic life you cultivate and develop, or get aroused or develop as you go along. And continuity and regularity is very important for letting them develop, but also for maintaining them, keeping them going. And I probably can't underscore enough from my own experience how important it is to maintain the good qualities that are developing in practice. Strength of mindfulness, strength of concentration, to develop it and to safeguard it, to recognize, something's happening here. Now, some people, when they practice mindfulness practice, think that nothing's supposed to happen. It's just supposed to be present for what is, and that luminous presence for what is just a wonderful spiritual state, a wonderful experience, spiritual experience. It can be. But I would argue or say that even to practice that, full presence for what is, just being present for what is, will bring along with it some of the factors of awakening over time. Some of the other qualities of the mind will develop and cultivate with that. It can't not do that. And then he started recognizing joy, recognizing tranquility, recognizing equanimity. Then honor it, respect it, nourish it, support it, protect it. Keep it going. Don't blow it. It's so easy to blow things. It's so easy to blow these good qualities they're developing. What comes to mind right now is like on retreats. You're going along, you're developing some concentration, some stability, some calm. All these things are developing on retreat. And these silent retreats we teach. And then it seems completely innocent to just go over to your friend who's on retreat too, and just, you know, ask your friend, how's it going with your retreat? It seems innocent, you know, it's light. You feel kind of free and easy, and your freedom and easiness, you know, it just seems like, oh, I can express it in conversation. And you go over and talk to your friend, and you talk for a little while, and you talk, and you don't even notice you're getting enmeshed and caught in the conversation. And finally, half an hour later, an hour later, you go back into your silence, and you're just exhausted. You know, the mind, all the clarity of the mind, or the energy, the equanimity of the mind, has just been dissipated, drained away. I remember once I sat for 4 months on retreat in silence. Except for talking to the meditation teacher for interviews, I didn't talk to anyone for 4 months. And then after 4 months, I said, oh, you know, I'll just talk to this guy who's in the room near me for some reason, I forget why. And no, he found me. I decided after 4 months to clean my room. You know, I was on an intensive retreat, so you try not to do anything else but meditate. So I thought it'd be good to. And so this other American, he saw me trying to, taking a little bit of time off to clean the room, tidy it up a little bit. He thought, oh, I'll go talk to Gil. So he talked to me, and I let him talk to me, and we talked for half an hour. And after the half an hour talk, I had to take a nap because it just really wiped out, it drained me so much because of the rarefied or very still state of mind that I attained. I kind of just blown it away with this conversation. So it's a little bit very wise about guarding and safeguarding states of mind, because you don't want to be attached, you don't want to be clinging to it, you don't want to be kind of holding off the world in some unrealistic, unhelpful way. But there's a lot of activities that we do that are draining, that drain us. And environments where we feel that the environments kind of drain us of our energy, our well-being, the good states we develop. And there can be a realistic and helpful way of choosing carefully what we do, the environments we go to, even the people we hang out with, so that we can try to maintain the good qualities that are beginning to kind of show themselves a little bit. Okay, let's support this. Let's keep this going. So one of the beautiful things about energy or effort, application, engagement in practice, is that it's an art form. It's art, and that we are always kind of finding our way in it, and it always changes a little bit depending on conditions, and we have to be interested in that whole topic of energy and effort and what's appropriate at different times, when to make a lot of effort, when to hold back and let things happen more, and just finding our way. And the other thing that's wonderful is that if you have a modest goal for your Dharma practice, then a modest amount of energy is enough. If you have a middling goal, then you'll need a middling amount of effort. And if you have, the ultimate goal, then you need to have some kind of ultimate effort, some great effort. If you have a great goal, then great effort's needed. Even if the great effort is the great effort to totally and completely get out of your way, get out of your own way, completely and thoroughly give up, surrender, let go, all the different attachments, momentums, and desires and wants of the mind, then just be here for this life as it is. So, we have a few minutes. Do you have any comments or questions about this? Clarifications you'd like? Yes, Rainbow.
I've heard you say...
Oh, please, Rainbow, if you use the mic.
This is Rainbow. I've heard you say something several times over the years that has puzzled me. I don't understand how it is possible to exert right effort to avoid unwholesome states from arising.
Mm. Well, you kind of meet a variety of things, what this means. One is you plan ahead. So if you know that, for example, that reading the newspaper every day, that you see those advertisements, and you know, you feel like, you know, you can't live without lipstick, and you get completely in a tizzy about lipstick or whatever, you know, and you realize after, you know, a month of doing this that, you know, this is not useful to be in a tizzy about lipstick every time I open the newspaper, so I think I'm not going to read the newspaper, or I'm going to figure out another way to do it. I'll get a different newspaper that doesn't have lipstick ads. You know, so it's avoiding, you see it, you know, you have a tendency, you see this happening over and over again, and you say, okay, I'm going to try to avoid the behavior so this doesn't arise again. Does that make sense? That's one thing. And the other is the practice of what's called, what I like to call, safeguarding ourselves at the sense doors. So you go into, you drive by a automobile dealership, and you see a brand new car, so you see it, and you stay very attentive at the experience of seeing, so you can leave it at that, as opposed to, that's what I want. How am I going to get that? Then I should sell. I wonder how much they give me for this car, and the whole greed thing kind of builds it up. So it means staying really attentive, so you stay there and you can catch and notice the first beginning of arising of something. So you don't take the bait. You might have the thought might arise, I think I'd like a new car. That's the bait. But you don't take the bait, and that's also considered avoiding the arising of unarisen, unskillful states. Those two ways. Peter.
I'm really glad that... Peter is my name. I'm really glad that you read today from that particular passage of the Buddha about striving, because striving today, I think, in our everyday language has taken on a negative meaning, and it's a favorite word of mine. to say that I'm going to try to sit today is different from saying I'm going to strive to sit today, in the sense that if I'm trying to do something, then I'm in the trying, I'm not in the doing. And striving is to do something, to actually do something, and when that falls away, when the effort somehow weakens and I fall from doing it, then I do it again. That's striving. And it's a really a wholesome activity.
Striving without any straining. Maybe. Striving not to strive. I'm serious. You can really, if you feel like striving or straining or grasping or gets in the way of your practice, which for many people it does, then there can be a very wonderful striving not to strive for a while. And anyway, there's so many different ways of engaging in practice. And again, as I said, it's the mindfulness, the art of effort, it's an art. And there's no one right formula for how to make effort in meditation practice or in Dharma practice. And in different circumstances, different times, for different people, different kinds of efforts are required and needed. And so part of the art of the practice is to know how to, you know, how to monitor yourself well enough to know what's needed in different circumstances and times. And hopefully in the process, enjoying it. Really enjoying. It's really enjoyable. Effort, engagement, activity can be really enjoyable. Like when you go hiking and you really get into the flow of it, it can be really enjoyable to walk and hike or do some other activity. And I really hope that all of you who might engage in a practice like this, that will find some way to find satisfaction from whatever effort you're making. So, thank you very much.